Welcome to the Into the Wild podcast, where we'll be interviewing outdoor junkies like ourselves about their experiences in nature. We hope to use this platform to continue learning and growing as both individuals and as an organization. We hope that you will accompany us on this journey of understanding the thrills others seek in the outdoors, the incredible memories and learning opportunities that can come from suffering experiences, and how the conversations we have can begin to make the outdoors a more just and equitable space for all people.
This episode, we will be talking with Stephen Carroll. Stephen is a senior lecturer in the English department at Santa Clara University and is also the academic director for the Miller Center Fellowship. Stephen has been an integral part of many Into the Wild leaders' times at Santa Clara, often spending an hour a week with students, including Jules and Morgan. He is thoughtful and charismatic, a deep listener, and is not afraid of asking the hard questions. Into the Wild leaders, Jules, Izzy, Cooper, and Morgan are so excited to welcome him into the KSCU office today to hear more about his time as a mentor and his perspective on growth mindsets, new experiences, and embracing the unknown. So without further ado, let's get into it. Thank you for being on here again, Stephen. Our first question for you is, what led you to become a mentor? And what do you find most rewarding about the experience?
Well, first, teaching is my calling. I've known this since I was 16 or 17 years old. One of the first experiences I've had was actually in Boy Scout camp, one of the first ways that I knew I was supposed to be a teacher. I was in charge of teaching first aid and emergency preparedness, wilderness survival. And one day at the evening assembly, we noticed that one of our people was missing. And we searched the camp for him, could not find him anywhere. So I was on deck, so I organized search parties, put people in place, and we fanned out across this wilderness area. About an hour and a half later, just as the sun was going down, we found him unconscious at the foot of a cliff. He had, nobody knows exactly what happened, but the best that we can reconstruct, he got spooked by a bear and ran over the edge of a cliff, where he landed on his head at the bottom of this cliff, about 30 feet down, and was knocked unconscious. So we picked him up and made a stretcher for him out of improvised materials, took him to the road, got him to the hospital. He got cleaned up, and he was basically eventually fine. But the reason why I say this was the first thing that reminded me that I needed to become a teacher was that I was so proud of the people who carried out that rescue expedition. I had taught them how to do all those things. And when it was an emergency and when we actually did have to use the things that we had been talking about for the last 3 or 4 weeks, everyone came together. They did what they were supposed to do. Nobody panicked. Nobody freaked out. And it went exactly by the book. He was saved. It was all good. And everyone was fine afterwards. The second thing I can say is the sort of the last moment that in this journey of becoming a mentor was I was sitting in the TA office at UC Berkeley. I was a grad student. I was a teacher. And there was this young woman who was walking around outside the TA's office. And she kept looking in, and then she would walk away, and then she would look in again. It was like 8:30 in the morning, this gray, cold day. And, you know, the third or fourth time she looked in, I said, "Can I help you?" And she said, "Well, I'm looking for my TA. He was supposed to meet me here. Help me with this paper that I'm writing." And I'm like, "Well, there's nobody here except me. And as far as I know, nobody else is coming. So maybe I could help you." And so she came in and she sat down. I said, "Well, you know, what are you doing?" And she said, "I'm working on this paper on a short story by Stephen Crane called The Open Boat. And, you know, you probably don't know it, but I need, you know, I have these ideas. And I have two different things I'm trying to say, and I don't understand how they fit together, but I know they're both important." And as it turned out, just a few weeks before, I had finished a class called Oral Interpretation of Short Stories. And my final presentation was on The Open Boat. So I had, in fact, memorized the story. I knew it inside out, backwards and sideways. And so I said, "Okay, so show me what you got." And she showed me. And I looked at it, and I asked her two questions. And all of a sudden, she could see how the ideas fit together. And her face just lit up. And she was so excited, she could barely stop talking. She said, oh, and this happens, and then this, and I could put that over here, and then I could do this, and I could do that. And then all of a sudden, her face fell. And I said, what just happened? And she said, now I have to wait for my TA to get here. And I said, no. I said, go now and write. If your TA ever shows up, I will tell him what happened. She left. I have no idea what happened to her. I never saw her again in my life. TA never showed up. But that moment of seeing her face light up when she figured it out and saw how all the things fit together just lit me on fire. I still remember it beautifully to this very day. So I knew immediately that this is what I want to pursue.
Wow. I know I've had some of those moments myself with you. So I'm wondering, with that, if you can describe a particularly impactful experience you have had either as a mentor or as a mentee yourself with that light bulb experience?
So the first one I'd say was being mentored myself. And the experience that jumps to mind first was I was in grad school, late in my grad career. I'd probably been in grad school for 8 years or so already. I'd written a whole bunch of my dissertation, but my director for my dissertation had gone on sabbatical for a year. And he said, you need to work with this other guy, not in the rhetoric department, but in the English department. And he will supervise what you're doing while I'm gone. And I was supposed to finish that year. And so I went to meet this new guy who I'd never met before. His name was Don McQuaid. And we had a meeting. It was lovely. And he took my dissertation and said, okay, I'll read this first chapter and then come back in a week and we'll talk about it. So fine. Week goes by. I come back and I said, well, you know, what did you think of my chapter? I was very happy about my chapter, his first chapter. And he said, well, you know, your ideas are pretty good. I like the way it's going, but your writing stinks. And I was like, wait, what? I'm a rhetorician. I teach writing. I had been teaching writing for probably 7 or 8 years at that point. And so I was really offended, of course. And so I went home mad and stewed about it for about a day and said, you know, how dare he think these things and blah, blah, blah. And the next day I went back and I got my chapter up and I started to read through it. And he was right. I had been paying so much attention to what I was trying to say, to my ideas, as he said, that I wasn't paying attention to my sentences. And the sentences used the same structures over and over again. There was no rhythm there. He was 100% right. And so that made a huge turning point in my career where I really learned how to pay attention, not just to the ideas, but to the way that they were executed. And then on the other side of it, mentoring for me is the most fulfilling thing that I can do. It's a very personal thing. As Plato says, teaching really is about love because you have to know the person that you're teaching deeply enough to know what they need to become their best selves and where they need to be challenged. That depends on trust, of course. Mm-hmm. So for me, mentoring is teaching at its highest level. It's teaching where it makes the most difference. And so the place where I get the rewards is seeing my students go on to become their best selves. So Jasmine Burnsall getting the Knight Hennessy Scholarship, Kate Ralph and Sammy Bennett earning Fulbrights to India, Britt Ames getting a job as the head of digital content for Michelle Obama's When We All Vote, Morgan, you and Maggie Walter going to Nepal last summer, Jules, you debriefing your trip to the Kalanau Trail last year, conversations with Miller Center fellows on the Nile in Uganda in 2019, I think. Shelby White deciding to live in Spain for 2 years and then getting into the London School of Economics and University College London to pursue her dream of building an ethical travel company built around storytelling. Emily Fagundes starting her own social enterprise to improve food justice. So when my students, especially the people that I form these strong relationships with, become their best selves, that's what fills me with joy.
Wow, yeah, those are some really powerful stories and experiences, and I'm glad that you're here today to share them with us.
So, kind of transitioning a little bit here, but our next question for you was about like growth mindset, and specifically how you think a growth mindset can help individuals to, you know, take advantage of new experiences and opportunities that may arise.
Yeah, growth mindset helps you take advantage of new experiences because it teaches you how to fail. Failure is the primary means by which we learn. So we need to fail often. And when I was teaching business writing all the time, I always used to tell my students, if you're not failing at least half the time, you're not trying hard enough. And I think in general, that's true, not just for business students. But if you're not failing pretty often, you're not challenging yourself enough, and you're not growing as you could and as you should. Lev Vygotsky, in his book about the proximal zone of learning, teaches us that for maximum growth, you have to push yourself about 10% past your current capacity. So, okay, cool. That's how we learn best. It's challenging. Part of the reason why it works that way is because stretching yourself in that way is motivating. It gives you energy. But it's also relatively safe. So to make it more exciting and to learn even faster, push a little bit harder, maybe 15 or 20% past your current capacity. That way you'll fail more often, but you'll also learn more. Now, what I don't recommend is trying something way, way past your capabilities. That doesn't help you because you can't learn much from that, and it's depressing to fail all the time. So don't seek failure just to fail. Fail smart. Fail up. Fail yourself by pushing to become a larger, better, more experienced person. That's how you come to know yourself, and that's how you come to acquire experience. And the way that I've always taught it, this is the essence of growth mindset. Growth comes from seeking new experiences, not shrinking from failure or from lack of self-confidence. So I recommend to you all, try it and see. The story I want to tell you is the metaphor of the candy store, which I often use to describe this process. And so you walk into a candy store, and it's filled with all kinds of candies. Candies from floor to ceiling of all the kinds, things you've never imagined. Some are known to you, some you like, some you don't. But if you always buy the candies that you know you like, you will walk away reasonably happy, but you will always wonder what you missed. So try to find a few new ones regularly. Start to learn how the store is organized so that you can figure out, oh, I don't like licorice, right? So I stay away from the licorice candies. Oh, but I do like these ones in the fruit section, so I guess I like fruit candies. But at the same time, every once in a while, pick something wildly new and different, something really outside the box. That's how you grow. Experience means that your database is bigger. And as it gets bigger and bigger, you make better choices, both because you understand yourself better and because you understand how the store is organized, so you make systematically better choices.
Thank you for that wisdom. To elaborate a little bit more, how can individuals cultivate a growth mindset when faced with challenges and setbacks?
First thing is, remember that you chose this path. The thing that puzzles me the most is people do this, they try something, they fail, and then they regret it. I'm like, well, why would you regret it? You chose it. It's what you decided to do. So don't waste time on regret. Don't waste time on blame. Do why you tried it in the first place. Gain that wisdom, gain the knowledge that you set out to acquire, and move on. Mm-hmm. And try again. Fail at something else. Mm-hmm. Growth mindset means you're always pushing your limits to try to find something that's new, something that's exciting, something that adds to that database, so you get wiser and more experienced as you go along.
That's such good advice. I think like one thing that stuck with me from the fellowship, Stephen, that I always think about is how you would always say, like, fail often, but smart and at the right time. And I think, yeah, that's just a huge part of it.
Yeah, you need to push yourself to grow, and growth mindset really exemplifies that well. So another question I have for you is, can you talk about a time when you had to push yourself out of your comfort zone to achieve this personal or professional growth? And what did you learn from this experience?
So this was the question when I looked over some questions in advance. This was the only one that I really struggled with. The other ones were like, okay, I know how to answer this question. But this one was tricky. And so upon reflection, I realized, okay, first of all, the thing that resonates for me the most is asking for help, because I always feel like, okay, I can do this. Asking for help is something that really goes against my basic nature. My default position is I can do this myself. But as I've gotten older, I've realized that that's not always the best way to approach the matter. I don't always get what I want, and it almost always takes longer than I want it to take. And I've also discovered that asking for help is not just good for me, but it's good for the people that I ask to help me. And that was a pivotal moment in my own reflection, because I realized that one of the things that brings me the biggest joy in life is being able to help other people. Mm. And so when I don't ask, when I struggle by myself, I'm depriving those people of that same joy that they might get from being able to help me. So I've learned to ask for help earlier and more often, not just because it helps me, but because it helps others as well. And so a good example, of course, is seeking therapy. And I always say, people say, oh, well, you go to therapy. Oh, that means, must mean you're weak or you have a problem. Like, my answer is always, if your life is perfect, you don't need therapy. But if it's not, chances are talking to somebody about why it isn't could help you make it better. And I think the reason for that is because when you ask yourself, why am I doing the things that are getting you in trouble or that are not going the way that you want them to go? What's causing you to keep making bad decisions over and over again? And to ask yourself, okay, what are the events, what are the traumas, the dramas, the false beliefs about yourself that you're protecting or that are giving you rewards? When you figure out what those causes are, when you figure out the reasons for why you're behaving the way you are, you can start to change them and you can begin to make better choices. So your life then becomes more aligned with who you are and what you want to do. So I'm going to go back to Steve Mayer, the guy who ran off the cliff. So as you'll see at the end of the story, he has a nickname in our troop. We call him Scarface. And not only because he landed on his face when he went off the cliff, but also this was the following year. He was a senior, I think he was 17. And so he was the hike master for our troop. And my troop is a very large troop. We had about 60 scouts. That would be like 45, what we call pedlies, who are ages 11 to 15, I think. And then 15 seniors who are 16, 17, 18. Who actually run the show, because we'd take these 60 people up to a wilderness area and we'd create a camp there, and we only had one adult who was there to supervise us for the entire month. And so so he was leading our hike for the whole troop, and we were about to cross this creek. And the way you cross the creek was, there's this gigantic old tree that had fallen across it. And from years of people walking across it, it had to become pretty smooth. And there were branches along the way that you could use as handholds as you walked. But it was very easy to get across. The tree must have been, I don't know, 2 feet wide on the flat part, right? Another foot on either side of curvy parts. So easy to walk across. So Steve gathers the troop together as we're about to cross. And he says, okay, everybody, we're about to cross this creek. Loosen the belts on your packs so you have better balance. And be super careful here. Go real slow. Don't hurry. We have plenty of time for everyone to get across. Just be safe. And he turns around and runs across the log and trips over one of the handhold branches, falls face forward into the creek below him. And when he fell down underwater, he fell in such a way that a piece of a submerged log, a branch really, pierced both of his cheeks and actually held him down underwater.
Oh, God.
And so he didn't come up. And so since I was the first aid guy and was right there, me and two other people jumped in the water and grabbed him, figured out what was happening, pulled him off of the branch, got him up above water so he could breathe. And then, of course, we had to get him back out to the hospital, the same one he'd been last year.
Wow.
And so got him to get some help. This is why he's called Scarface. It was definitely outside of my comfort zone to dive into the creek and pull him out when there's blood in the water and you can't really see. And he was going to die if he stayed in there.
Yeah.
But I want to tell another story that is the opposite. And the opposite is when you get too comfortable in your comfort zone. Because when you get too comfortable, you stop thinking. And so I'm going to use another example from outdoors. I was in charge of leading one of the patrols whose responsibility it was to build the campfire for the evening campfire after dinner. And so we went out, we gathered wood, and we got everything together, and we started to build this campfire, and it starts to rain. And we're like, okay, so we're going to need to get extra flammable material into the bottom of this campfire to get it lit. So I sent one of the people down to the commissary area and he came back with two toilet paper rolls that had been soaked in kerosene. And so put those underneath the fire and at the base of the thing. And then we built this log cabin fire all the way around it. It's big because that's to be for 60 people, right? So as we're up there building the fire, the storm is getting more intense and we're up on top of this ridge. And you could start to feel the electricity gathering in the air and to the point where your hairs are standing up all the way down your arms. And so we knew that we were way too high and that we were at risk for lightning. But like I said, we're in our comfort zone. We're outdoors. This is a place we've been for years. We know how all this works. So we decided to do something really stupid. We took a long wooden pole that was wet and we braced it that it sat directly above the rolls of toilet paper in the center of the fire. No fire yet, right? Just a fire ready to go. And then we all went a little bit down from the ridge and hid behind rocks and waited until lightning struck the pole, which it did, and lit the fire.
What?
And so... And then we realized, okay, this was phenomenally stupid. and we had to rebuild the fire, of course, for that evening. It was fun, but massively dangerous.
Yeah.
And so, the corresponding thing I'll bring up in regular day activities is, if you've been paying attention, you'll notice that over the last 5 to 10 years, the rates of pedestrian injuries and pedestrian deaths have been going up consistently. And it's because people text and drive, and they do that because they are in their comfort zone. Everyone says, oh, yeah, I can do this, no problem. And they can't, and they hit people.
Mm.
So the comfort zone can be just as dangerous as being out of the comfort zone.
Yeah.
Wow, that's interesting. I would have never thought that that was the reasoning, but it is an interesting point, and it makes sense.
Thank you for those stories. So I'm curious about mentors in your life and how you found them. Because often, you know, at Santa Clara or in people's daily lives, they're going about classes and then going to friends. And luckily I found a mentor and a few of my peers have also found mentors like you. And they've really encouraged me to step outside of my comfort zone. And so this is kind of a twofold question, but what kind of mentors have you had in your life? And what advice would you give to others who are looking for a mentor and how to find one?
Mentors I've had a lot. I remember a high school English teacher who really took time with me to, help me love to write. There's a story that my wife tells about, which I actually don't remember. But she says, so we were in this class together and our English teacher, Johnny Selvin, gave this assignment about the Invisible Man and something else. And apparently I immediately raised my hand and said, can I combine both of them into one paper? And which she agreed to, and I later did. But Andrea said that was the moment which she actually figured out my nature more than anything. But Johnny Selvin, she was an amazing teacher. And really helped me fall in love with writing. I would say Don McQuaid, the guy that I mentioned earlier about my graduate school experience. Phyllis Brown, when I first came to Santa Clara, was super helpful in acclimating me to this place and teaching me what to do and sort of how to go about it. Right now, I'd say Sarita Tamayo-Moraga is like a spiritual mentor to me. We have long conversations about Buddhism and about how to handle different events in your life. So I've had a string of really amazing mentors. And I would say a couple of things about that. One is remember that they're not heroes. They're people that you can get something from, but that doesn't make them perfect. So don't expect that from them because you will always be disappointed. Mm-hmm. And I'm reminded of George Box's comment. He said, all models are wrong, but some are useful. Mm-hmm. And I think that we need to take that in relationship to mentors as well. We're all flawed, but we have things that we can say and do that will help other people. And so when you look for your mentors, look for the ways that they can help you rather than looking at the things and the ways that they can't help you. And sort of in ways that you wouldn't, you know, want to go about it, I say, look carefully at the people that you interact with. The people who take a little bit of extra care with you, the people who seem to respond to what you need even before you know what you need exactly. Mm-hmm. And then think about which ones are doing the best with the kinds of things that you struggle with. All professors have students that they care about, mm-hmm. so figure out which ones care about you. Then go approach them. Go to office hours. Talk to them. If it goes well, make another appointment. Go talk to them again. If that goes well, ask them if you can have a regular relationship with them. And part of that is being vulnerable, right? It's, as I said, it's asking for help, even if you're not the kind of person who wants to feel like, oh, I need help. Ask for it anyways. Be vulnerable with them. Be honest with them. Not too much information. You're not trying to, shock them or, you know, create a trauma bonding experience. That's not the goal here, right? Instead, you're trying to actually get to know them and to help them get to know you so that they can actually help you with the things that you want to be helped with. Mm. And last piece of advice I'd give is ask your friends, like, and not ask them to be your mentors, but ask them who would be a good mentor for you. Mm. Because they, in many cases, know you better in this way than you know yourself. And they also can read other people and how other people react to you better than you can. Mm. Because you're going to see through your own bias. Mm. And so you're going to say, oh, no, they just treat me the way everybody else does. But people around you will know better. They will say, oh, no, they treat you different. Go find that person and talk to them. Mm. Because that difference means they care about you.
Thank you for that. I know I always really appreciate finding people to talk to, and I really appreciate everything you just shared. Moving on to our next question, how can individuals balance the desire for growth and self-improvement with the need to stay grounded and focused in the present moment?
I love this question when I read it. I really did. I was like, because I'm like, okay, these things are not opposites. Yeah. Do both.
Right. I was so eager to ask you this question when I read it. I was like, Steven's definitely going to have something to say.
Staying grounded in yourself, especially if you have a growth mindset, means growing yourself, right? I mean, that desire for growth, that desire for self-improvement is an intrinsic part of who you are. So embracing the present moment and being grounded in yourself means reaching out. It means taking advantage of the opportunities that are available to you. So don't use grounding or focus or, oh, I need to be in the present moment as an excuse not to learn and not to grow. You should always be asking yourself, what can I learn from this? What can I do right now that's going to help me get closer to what I want to do? What's going to be interesting? What's exciting? What are the opportunities here? And the farther outside the box you think, the better it is, right? Try everything and keep going until you need to rest. Mm. It's like I said, these two things are not opposites, and there's no such thing as balance here because they're the same thing. And especially the people who are in front of me right now, like I don't know you two. I don't know Cooper and Izzy yet, but I know Jules and Morgan. And the fact that all of you, even the ones I don't know, are leaders, not just participants of Into the Wild, but leaders of the group, tells me that you're people who are adventurous, that you're eager for new experiences, that you're trying to grow yourself, that you're trying to expand who you are. So you, by definition, push yourselves to grow in experience and wisdom. That's part of who you are. So being yourselves is seeking growth and self-improvement. That's how you become fully who you are.
Mm-hmm. So you just mentioned how we're currently trying to grow and improve ourselves. I'm going to throw that question back to you and ask you what you're currently doing to try to have some self-growth and improvement.
That's a good question. So in the fall, upcoming fall, I'm on sabbatical. And to get a sabbatical, you have to make a proposal to do something that is worthy of them giving you this time off. So I made a proposal and said, okay, I'm going to write a book about how I teach, why I teach the way I do. And so, fine, they said, yes, you can do that. And I, you know, what I had sent them, I actually, at this point, have no intention of doing because I got a better idea. Mm. And the better idea is actually a really scary one, but I think it's going to be really fun. And as I started thinking about why, who I am as a teacher and why I teach the way I do, the first thing that I encountered and the first thing that my former students who I was talking to about this said to me is, at the center of your pedagogy, at the center of the way you teach, is always, there are always two things. There's empathy or compassion, however you want to call that, and there's community, right? And those are the two first learning goals of any class that I teach, is to, for people to get more compassionate, more empathic, and to get better at forming supportive communities. Because if you don't have that, you can't take risks. And so to learn to write and to learn to think and to learn to grow in all these ways, you have to trust people around you enough to get feedback from them. So you have to have empathy and you have to have community. So I said, okay, so that has to be part of my book. And so from there, it's an easy leap to say, all right, so that means that my students, past and present, have to be voices in the book. So I'm still figuring out what the prompts are, but in the next couple of weeks, I'm going to be sending out to 100, maybe 150 people who I've formed these kind of relationships with over the last 20 years, asking them to reflect on some of these experiences, not just what they got, but what their questions were, what they needed, why they were there in these particular places. And the book will be a conversation between me and them. But it also means, and this is the really scary part, I have no idea what they're going to say. So structuring it and figuring out how to turn it into something that's coherent and makes sense as a book is going to be challenging, to say the least. It will be fun, though. I'm really looking forward to it.
Have you ever read the book Tuesdays with Maury? Oh,
I have not.
That's a great book.
So it's reminding me a little bit about that book. I actually have given it to a lot of my friends, but it's this guy who meets with this man named Maury, who I think is diagnosed with ALS. And he, throughout the time that he's meeting with him, he's gradually getting worse and worse as his condition moves on. But he gains like invaluable insights from him every Tuesday that he meets with Maury. And he travels from lengths, I think from like different states actually, to go and meet with his mentor from college, and has a lot of really impactful stories that he shares throughout the book. So I'd highly recommend listening to that.
Maybe it will help me actually organize some of these things as the information starts to come in. Because it's not going to be linear.
Right.
Yeah. So that's really interesting. And I think that is a lofty goal and a very powerful one too. And a question I have for you is, I often struggle with setting my goals. I have a lot of wants and desires, but making it achievable and making it something that I'll stick to can be difficult for me. So So I'm curious as to your process in creating your goals and your ideals.
Process. Process begins with noticing. So noticing what are the things that you keep coming back to. And the reason why I say that is because the hardest thing, I think, is to separate what you actually want from what you think you should want and what other people around you want and what they think you should want. And so being able to separate those things is the first step. You have to decide what you actually want, which, of course, involves having some grasp of who you are to begin with, but also noticing when those things keep coming up. I told you the story earlier about the girl with the short story about open boat and about Steve running off the cliff. And at the time when those things happened, I didn't really listen to them. They were very important experiences, and I recognized that at the time, but I was determined that I was going to be a lawyer, right? And that I was going to go and maybe I hoped one day to be a justice on the Supreme Court. It was my, you know, that was my aspiration. And it wasn't until I actually got into law school that I realized I would hate that. I would hate it so much. And because I hadn't really stopped to consider what was going to be good for me. But I was much more caught up in what other people thought success was. And so since I could do it, I did. And what I should have noticed, and in retrospect, actually there's these sort of three or four key moments that I would say, you know, fate or whatever was beating me over the head with a 2x4 saying, listen, like, you need to be a teacher, right? This is the thing that you're good at. This is the thing that your destiny is. So learning to listen to yourself, and it's not easy, but start there, because that's going to tell you the key goals that you have to organize everything else around. And then, as I've been saying all along, take chances, fail, risk, aim higher, and keep striving for those things. And as you do that process, your experience gets bigger, your database gets bigger, you make better choices, but also you change and the world around you changes. As those things happen, you adjust too, right? And so you get better at making choices that preserve the pieces that are essential and adapt them to the circumstances as you grow and as the circumstances change. So, but yeah, start with noticing, because that's going to teach you where you need to go.
Yeah, thank you for that. I think that's really powerful. Something I'll definitely keep with me and think about. I'm not sure. I'd love to talk to you after the episode about it more.
Just one more question that I have for you personally, Steven. I think listeners could benefit from, especially because I feel that I've picked your brain about this one recently. But I would love to just, if you could touch on like pivoting and also how you've been able to like pursue so many different disciplines and realms. You know, how like you started in tech and now you're like in teaching, and just how you've been able to like pivot so many different times throughout your life, and any like advice you may have for especially, you know, college students as we're progressing throughout like these formative years.
It's a great question. I think the siren song, the danger point, is the fact that you're all smart, talented people, which means that you can do a lot of things. And it means that you will probably be good at a lot of things. But being good at something doesn't mean that you should do it. It doesn't mean that it's going to make you happy. So, going back to noticing, learn to listen to the differences between things that make you happy and things that don't. So you talked about, I had a career in tech, and I did. And I was good at it, but I didn't love it. And so after I accomplished my purpose, I left and went back to things that I loved. But this whole thing is part of the same pattern that we've been talking about all along, which is that be an opportunist, right? The reason why I've had so many careers and done so many different kinds of things is because when an opportunity comes along and it looks interesting, I will do it. And it doesn't matter what it is. And if it's terrible, then you stop and say, okay, I need to do something else, right? But if it's not terrible, then you go for a while and see, okay, do I love this? And if not, again, you pivot. But all of you, because of the nature of the way our economy is and the way our country works, are going to have multiple careers, right? It's not going to be like in my grandfather's day when you got one sort of job and then you kept that job, you know, for 30 or 40 years and then you retired and got a gold watch or whatever. Everything that we know about what's happening right now says people switch jobs on the average 3 years. Most people switch jobs every 2 years. You're going to have something like 15 to 20 different kinds of jobs after you graduate from college. You'll have more than 10 of them before you hit 40. So it means you're going to be doing a lot of pivoting. So don't be afraid of it, right? Lean into it. When you leave something, whether it's because you're bored or because you get fired or because your job expands or your job expires or whatever, there's a million opportunities out there. Find something that looks interesting to you. Go for that.
That reminds me of a conversation that we had last week, Stephen, about sunken costs. And for me personally, hearing that I'm going to have 15 to 20 jobs is exciting, but also I keep thinking about, you know, you invest so much time into something that you love and they're perceived as these sunken costs. So you feel an obligation to continue or help progress or move on. And it's hard to move on sometimes, or it's hard to, you know, transition into another job per se. And I don't know. I just think that was a really valuable conversation that I had last week about not letting those sunken costs hold you back. And you will always have sunken costs throughout your life, and you can't let that influence your decisions.
No, the sunken cost fallacy is, I mean, military leaders do that all the time and say, oh, well, we can't abandon this position because all the guys who died defending it will, you know, it dishonors their memory. Yeah, but if you sacrifice more guys, then it just gets worse. And so the other thing is, so it's a sunken cost fallacy, that's what we call it. But what you were talking about, Jules, is actually something else. Is what you're talking about is the fact that you get emotionally invested in the things that you're doing, that you care about them, and so you want to keep going. Not a bad thing. But switching horses doesn't mean that you let go of that. One of the things that I've learned, even though I've had all these different experiences, been high tech, been in retail, been a clothing designer, been bicycle manufacturer, like all these different kinds of things, all of them help me in what I do now. Every single one of them, even being a Boy Scout. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you how many times it comes up. When I landed in Africa, being a Boy Scout gave me skills in a place where I'd never been before that made me feel comfortable there. Understanding tech allows me to understand what my students are doing in a dimension that would be invisible to me if I didn't have it. Mm. So being in retail allows me to advise people about ways of interacting with the public that I would never have if I hadn't had that experience. So all that experience that you gain and all that emotional investment that you make, all that still has value, and it's not going to go away. And as you go along the life path, all of the things that you've learned are going to keep coming back to you. And so it's sunk cost in a way, but the value is still there. And that's going to stay with you no matter what happens.
Yeah, thank you. It's really important to remember that, especially for me, because I know I'm going to be doing a lot of different things in my life and need to remember that I'm going to continue using those skills no matter what kind of job I have. Yeah, so I think that's most of the questions that we have for today. we want to thank you again for taking the time to come in and talk with us and get our spring quarter off to a good start with the Into the Wild podcast. So for listeners, we can't wait to continue bringing you more content. Stay tuned for our next episode that will be announced in our weekly emails. Until then, get up, get out, and get wild.